everyone. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is the one program each week that I try to take on an important, possibly a controversial issue, and bring together one or more minds to share their point of view. Today, we're going to hear from former Guardian writer Melanie Phillips, and she's going to describe her journey from fantasy to reality and why she left the political left. Now, Phillips is interviewed by The Sun's Stephen Eddington for the weekly series Burning Questions. And Phillips describes her experiences as a British Jew dealing with anti-Semitism and where the problems of the left come from. This is one of the most articulate, intelligent, and incisive comments that I've heard from an individual, right or left. And I also think that it's time that we began to stop for a moment and drop all the pretense that one side versus the other, one group, one race, one ethnicity, one religion, is above and beyond all reproach. Because a lot of times what people are angry about themselves, they project upon other people. The same with groups. On a recent broadcast, I equated the French Revolution and the Robespierre and Robespierreans, those who believed in him, and they wanted change, but they didn't want anyone else to be a part of that change. It was absolute. And there's a danger when you have absolutism. And shouldn't in any society we encourage people to share different points of view? And so today we're going to have also some comments from two other people, both controversial, but I believe it's these controversial people who are highly intelligent that we should listen to and then take issue with, in part or whole, what they say. What I do not believe in is censorship. And I've seen so much of it. I remember in the 1980s when I was looking at all the different questions that had not been properly answered concerning AIDS. Was it due to one single virus? 30 different conditions, including one condition that was just absurd, cervical cancer. And they were saying, yes, cervical cancer is due to the HIV virus. Yet they had no scientific findings to support that. And I remember in particular being at UCLA at Berkeley. And I was there to film a woman, Borshenko, and she was a medical doctor who was treating people with AIDS using a combination of some antibiotics for some of the infections, but also nutrition. And she was having terrific success. And while there, a PhD came over to me, and he was working in a laboratory, and he said, there's a professor who would like to speak with you. I said, fine. So I finished my filming. I went up to see this professor. His name was Professor Stroman. He was the chairman of the department. I believe it was in molecular biology. Anyhow, he wasn't alone. There was another professor with him. I believe his name was Dr. Bailey, and he was also a chairman. And what they had to tell me was just remarkable. It was one of those clarion moments. They said, we're going to share some things with you in confidence, or at least keep it in confidence until such time that we're no longer at the university. And they've been at the university for decades. And by the way, it turns out they're two of the most respected scientists in American history, two of the most cited. And yet here they were talking with me because they were concerned that the war on AIDS had been politicized and weaponized, that some of the brightest minds like Dr. Peter Duisberg, who was their colleague in molecular biology, and as Dr. Stroman said something like this. He said, we have an awful lot to learn, but Peter Duisberg, who is one of the founders of the National Academy of Science and one of the best and brightest of scientists in America, one of the most cited scientists, he knows a lot, yet they have shut down his lab. He doesn't get a penny in funding because his position on AIDS is different from Robert Gallo or Anthony Fauci. And we're opposed to this. He said, we're both old enough to remember McCarthyism and what that stood for and why we stood against it. And he said, we believe that Peter is right, that AIDS is due to an HIV virus, yes, but other lifestyle causative factors. That's what we've seen in our own experience here in San Francisco. And we'd like that message to get out. And I said, well, I intend to have multiple voices, credible voices, speak out. And they said, you realize that the establishment, both the media, will not touch the story, your side. Everybody's on board on one side only. There's only one truth, and that's the official truth. That's where the money is. That's where the grants are. That's where Anthony Fauci will allow hundreds of millions of dollars to be given to people as long as you agree to his orthodoxy, that one single virus, HIV, is able to cause all these 30 conditions, even when you can't find it in the body. I remember one of them saying that. Well, I filmed them. And later, honoring their word, when they were both no longer at the university, I put that in a documentary, and AIDS is Second Opinion. And I think this is important because right now, we don't hear other voices. You don't hear them on college campuses. You don't hear very bright people who have a different point of view. And I believe we should listen to other points of view. We should encourage open and lively debate and discord. But we're not. Everything right now is from the woke society and young people who are considering themselves the idealist running in the streets and protesting legitimately, yes, engaging in violence or demands that we restructure all of society without looking at the consequences to this because they've gotten themselves like Robespierre behind an ideology. So they're revolutionary times now in the United States, not the same as in 1793 in France, but it's growing. So I'm bringing some additional voices on to this. And now we're going to go to two parts of hearing Melanie Phillips. Just listen to what she has to say, because this transcends being right or left, conservative or not. But she's at the, for almost 30 years, she was right in the heart of the most liberal publication in Great Britain, The Guardian, until she had her awakening.
After a series of last straws, I finally left Guardian newspapers and left the left. Really, I think they've not ever quite forgiven me.
To get Brexit.
Make America great again.
No, no, no.
This is Stephen Edgington for The Sun, and today I'm interviewing Melanie Phillips. Melanie Phillips is an author, a commentator, and a writer. She used to work for The Guardian newspaper, although you probably wouldn't suspect that from some of the views that she holds. We're going to be talking about anti-Semitism, her journey from left to right, and the left in general. I have to apologise. Unfortunately, there might be a noise in the background due to the wind bashing on a window behind us. We can't do anything about it. I'm extremely sorry. Despite our name, we don't control the weather, so enjoy the interview. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you explain what you think has happened to society since 1945?
Small question. I think that in the West, there's been a kind of cultural revolution that's gone on since 1945, since the end of the Second World War. And I think it very much actually has its roots in the war and the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s, because I think what that did to Europe in particular, but to the West in general, was to deliver a kind of seismic shock to what the West thought of itself. Because you had this unprecedented barbarism arising in the very heartland of high culture, Enlightenment reason. And it didn't take place in some benighted cultural backwater in some far-flung part of the world. It took place in the heart of Europe. And I think what that did was to give people a terrible impression, a terrible message that this is what reason did, this is what the West did, this is what being a nation did. And so all those things became toxic and tainted. And I think that was a terrible mistake, personally, because what gave rise to Nazism and to anti-Semitism and to the Nazi Holocaust and to the war that followed was particular to a particular country at a particular time in history, governed by a particular set of circumstances, and prey to a particular set of prejudices. But nevertheless, I think there was a kind of cultural demoralization that set in the West. And as a result, it became very vulnerable to people who wanted to change Western society completely. And they came out of the Holocaust, they came out of Nazi-dominated Europe, and they were revolutionary Marxists, many of them. And they basically said, we did this, capitalism did this, the West did this, Enlightenment reason did this, and we now have to have a new society. And so that set in train a whole series of, a whole set of thinking, which, because I think the West was demoralized, it was very receptive to these ideas, which basically involved overturning the basic tenets of Western civilization and the very idea of the Western nation state that embodied those concepts. So you had this great onslaught which took place progressively over the decades on the bedrock values of the West, transmitted through, for example, the traditional family, which became seen as the sort of epicenter of oppression, the onslaught on capitalism as a profoundly destabilizing and unfair doctrine, and the onslaught on education. Education is the transmission of a culture down through the generations. And I remember sitting through debates in the 80s and 90s in Britain, in which the received wisdom in the higher reaches of the education system was that you could not transmit the culture anymore down through the generations, because the culture was fundamentally rotten. It was fundamentally racist, it was white, it was colonialist, it was defined by colonialism, exploitation, capitalism. It had done down the poor at home and the benighted masses abroad, and consequently it needed to be completely revised and overthrown, and consequently you couldn't teach that to children. You had to teach them instead that they were born into a culture that was itself born in sin. And I remember those debates, and there was the people who objected to this as being ahistorical, false, malevolent, destructive, were just howled down as being, they would say that, wouldn't they? They are white, they are capitalists, they are the powerful. And so you had this destruction of the bedrock values of the West. And even more profoundly, you had a destruction, again, in the higher reaches of the universities, at the intelligentsia. You had the destruction of the very idea of truth itself. And this is how this worked. Again, arising from the experience of Nazi authoritarianism, Nazi totalitarianism, there arose a way of thinking which said any kind of external authority is authoritarian. It's an intrusion on our personal freedom and has to be resisted. The only thing that now matters, the only thing that counts, is how we ourselves create our own lives. So what matters more than anything else is how we believe ourselves to be. What I think matters more than what you think. You cannot tell me I am wrong, because my view is the same as your view. There's no hierarchy of views. There can be no hierarchy of opinion, of values, of culture. Nothing can be better or worse than anything else. No one's lifestyle can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's family background can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's national culture or religion can be better or worse than anyone else. If you say that it is better or worse than anyone else's, then you're racist. So as a result, liberal society could no longer say that it was better than illiberal society. We could no longer say it was better, objectively better to have a society based on ideas of equality between men and women, freedom of religion, and all the rest of it, because that was racist, because it distinguished us from those countries which didn't have that. So what mattered was how I felt was what was true. What I feel myself to think, what I feel, and my feelings, my emotions, are more important than any facts. Because I create my own reality. And as a result of that, you had an erosion of the idea of objective truth. Objectivity went out the window. You couldn't have objectivity. You couldn't have rules of evidence. You couldn't have any rules. What I say is true is as true as what you say is true. It's all relative. And consequently, the world, as recreated along these lines, no longer understood the difference between truth and lies. And consequently, it accepted lies as truth. It was even worse than this, because in this great drive to get rid of any kind of external authority, biblical morality, of course, went out the window. Biblical morality was regarded as a grotesque intrusion onto personal freedom. And also it was based on the Bible, and who cared about the Bible? It was all magical, superstitious, mumbo-jumbo, only believed by idiots and imbeciles. That's what we've been told for the last half century. And so biblical morality went out, and in came man-made morality, which was basically ideology, the power of the idea. And these ideologies were all basically designed to produce a kind of perfect world. They would get rid of prejudice from the human heart. They would prevent war from ever happening again. They would prevent Nazism from ever again stalking the corridors of free societies. They would produce a brotherhood of man. And consequently, they couldn't brook any opposition because they were all designed to better humanity in their own lights. And consequently, anyone who said there was anything wrong with any of them was somebody who wasn't just wrong-headed. They were somebody, by definition, who did not want to better humanity. So they weren't just wrong. They were evil. And so if somebody came along and said, you know, I don't think it's necessarily right that the West invented slavery. In fact, the West, everyone had slavery at one time. And in fact, Britain and America were the pioneers of getting rid of slavery. This is historical fact, but it goes against the ideology which says, you know, white people are intrinsically bad. And consequently, those facts could not be admitted as facts. And anyone who said them was, by definition, evil, because they were people who were against the whole anti-racist idea that only white people could be racist and all that. And consequently, you had a situation. You had a situation arising, which we're living through, having sown the wind, we're reaping the whirlwind through identity politics, victim culture, woke stuff, and all that, in which the power of the idea was absolute; it could not be gainsaid. And consequently, anyone who opposed it had to be treated as somebody who had to be shut down, as being evil. And it's an amazing thing that in getting rid of biblical religion, what we've done by substituting man-made ideologies is produce something that's very, very similar to the very worst excesses of medieval religions. You have a dogma, you have a catechism. The dogma cannot be challenged. It must be enforced. Anybody who opposes it is a heretic who must be burned at the stake. Now, we don't burn people physically at the stake anymore, but we burn them in other ways. We deprive them of their livelihoods. We prevent them from being promoted. We prevent them from having their friends. We treat them as social pariahs and outcasts, and that's what we've done. So it's very, very similar to the medieval inquisitions produced by the Catholic Church, and then on through the French Revolution and subsequent secular revolutions, communist totalitarianism, and then fascism. We're reproducing those totalitarian cultures in a secular form and on the basis that this is producing This is supposed to produce a better world, a freer world, a kinder, gentler world, in response to all those terrible things that happened in the past. We've gone full circle.
I feel like we've just conducted the whole interview there in one question. We can all pack up and go. I want to go back to something you mentioned there about objective truth. Now, you talk about personal experiences sort of triumphing over fact in that sense. But I do want to ask about your own personal experiences. Hopefully this won't triumph over fact. Hopefully we can keep it based in reality. You were deeply entrenched in understanding all of these so-called postmodern ideas that you've just described there so eloquently, because you used to work for The Guardian for a very long time. And then you've had your journey going from left and being in, you know, the centre of, with all these people who have hold those beliefs sincerely, to kind of coming up to where you are now, where you've just had this fantastic monologue talking about our society. So can you talk about your journey from left to right?
Yes, as I prefer to think it, from fantasists to realists, because I think left and right no longer has purchase. But yes, I worked for Guardian newspapers for the best part of 20 years, about 17 of those for The Guardian itself, and then The Guardian bought The Observer, and I worked with The Observer for 2 or 3 years. As I have often said to my former Guardian colleagues, and amazingly they don't seem to like it when I say this very much, The Guardian made me what I am today, because I was exposed to ideas which I thought were ideas that I shared. And I thought that I was in the company of people who were like me. And I discovered, or I came to the conclusion, that they weren't like me. And there were many stages along this journey. It took a long time for me to realize that the divisions between me and the Guardian way of thinking, it wasn't just the Guardian, it was the left, were so profound that I could no longer feel comfortable in that environment, and that's why I left Guardian newspapers. But what happened was, when I joined The Guardian, I thought we were all marching behind the same banner. I didn't actually consider myself to be the left. I was never ideological. But at university and then at The Guardian, I'd mixed with people who were, I thought, were like me. I thought of myself as a liberal. That is to say, I believed in making a better world. I believed that people were capable of good and bad stuff, and it was everyone's duty to try and maximise the good and minimise the bad. I cared about abuses of power. I cared about people who were powerless. I cared about people who were being oppressed. I cared about poverty. And I wanted to do good in the world. I have not changed any of those views, none. But what changed very radically was my belief that the people that I thought were on my side were not.
The Guardian is a really interesting theme, and we'll come back to that later, because recently there's been an issue with trans rights, and The Guardian has been at the epicentre of that fight, but we'll talk about that later. Let's talk about Judaism. Now, your parents are Jewish, and they came from Belarus and Poland, Russia, over to Britain. And I'm going to talk about my experience of Judaism, because I think it's probably similar to a lot of people in Britain, in that I grew up not knowing almost anything about it, never met a Jew until I was 18 or something. Yeah. And at school, the first time I'd heard about Jewishness or Judaism was in about the Holocaust. And someone, I think when I was 13, 14, someone made an anti-Semitic joke when I was at school, and I just thought, I genuinely remember this. It really stuck out to me, thinking, well, why would anyone hate a Jewish person? What's so wrong? You know, what is it about Jewish people that people don't like? And I never could quite get my head around that. And now, being in journalism, being in politics, you see so much anti-Semitism recently with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, and the rise of anti-Semitism within Britain. And a lot of that comes from the left. Now, historically, it's come from the right, but recently, and you've experienced this, you've talked about that experience at The Guardian, about that coming from the left. Why does it come from the left, and why has it grown so much, or has it been allowed to grow in British politics in the last few years?
Yes, well, first of all, on my own background, my parents were both born in Britain. My maternal and paternal grandparents and great-grandparents variously came from Belarus and Poland. Well, my maternal grandparents actually born in Britain, so that's one generation back. And I was brought up in a, at the time, conventional British Jewish family. We observed the rules of kosher. We were kosher at home. And my parents didn't go to the synagogue very often. They went on the most important festivals of the year, but apart from that, they didn't. We didn't observe the Sabbath, as Orthodox Jews do. They observe it very strictly. So it was a kind of mixed, in terms of observance, it was a bit mixed, but that was quite typical of British Jews at the time. But what I was brought up with was a very, very, very strong sense of Jewish identity and of separateness. I didn't have a great deal of anti-Semitic experiences as a child, occasional social stuff, but it was very much, it was confined to the social fringes. People, you know, these were sort of eccentrics, weirdos who would say this kind of thing. And it was regarded with total disapproval. And what I didn't, not, what none of us, I think, realised at the time, none of us realised it, was that after the discovery of the extermination camps in the Holocaust, anti-Semitism went underground. It became socially completely unacceptable. And that lasted for about 50 years. And it changed. It changed. Now, it didn't change with Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn was an extreme version of something that had been going on for some decades prior to that. And I think what caused it to emerge again, and this is what I think I saw in the 1980s when I had that experience at The Guardian over the Lebanon War. That was the first time I think the first time I'd heard Israelis or Jews called Nazis. But that went back also to the United Nations declaration that Zionism was racism. And this may sound terribly cynical, but nevertheless it's what I believe to be true, that what happened in that 50-year holiday from anti-Semitism was it hadn't gone away. Anti-Semitism never goes away. You say you never really understood it. No one actually understands it. There are all kinds of plausible explanations as to why people hate the Jews the way they do, but anti-Semitism is not a racism like any other racism. It is unique. It simultaneously regards Jews as lower than vermin and as people of such power they control the entire world. It is unique because it is murderous. It is basically murderous. It views the Jews as a satanic conspiracy to destabilize the world in their own interests, and therefore they had to be removed. It's fundamentally murderous. So it's unique and ultimately inexplicable. Okay, so why did it suddenly become what it became, what it has become? And I think that what happened after the war, after the discovery of the extermination camps, as I say, it went underground because of the enormity of what had happened. But I think people were all the time thinking, you know, these Jews are getting away with it. All the things we think about them, that they basically control everything and they want to control everything and they're basically this and that, all these anti-Semitic ideas, we can't say anymore. We're forbidden to say it because they were all murdered. And that's awful because, like, they're getting a free pass. And then along came Israel. Along came Israel, framed, as the left framed it, as a colonialist, a white colonialist enterprise, putting down the brown-skinned Palestinian Muslims. In fact, this is completely wrong. Most of Israel, believe it or not, is brown-skinned. You know, more than half of the Jews of Israel come from Arab lands. They are brown-skinned. And there are 20% of Israel is Arab. So most of Israel is brown skin. But anyway, the idea is that because it's Jews, because it's a Jewish state, a Jewish country, it's white capitalist because we know that the Jews run the world. It's basically an anti-Semitic view to see Israel as a white colonialist settler state. It ignores the fact that the Jews are the only people for whom Israel, the land of Israel, was ever their national kingdom. centuries before Islam was ever invented, centuries before the Arabs invaded. It completely ignores all of that. Most people didn't even know about that. So anyway, the left frames Israel as this white colonialist enterprise. And as a result, I'm afraid the anti-Semitic West said, hurrah, we can once again be horrible about the Jews. All the obstacles of anti-Semitism are now removed. And we can say, if Jews say this singling out of Israel for a campaign of defamation, lies, in order to delegitimize it and destroy it, a unique campaign, singling out Israel for vilification and destruction, just as Jews are singled out for vilification and destruction, and it is in fact the new anti-Semitism, if Jews say that, they're waving the shroud of anti-Semitism to sanitize the crimes of Israel. So anti-Semitism then became something you couldn't even talk about. You couldn't say it. You couldn't say this is what was going on. And out it came. Out it really came. And we've lived through this for, well, I would say ever since the 80s. Scroll forward, and you get Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn comes out of, it came out of the far left. And the far left absolutely sees Israel in this way. But it also, the far left also sees Jews as the capitalist conspiracy. I mean, all the sort of anti-capitalist stuff, the protesters against the City of London, the Occupy movement and all that. And, all the stuff about after the banking crisis, the crisis of 2008 and the bankers getting away with it. It was all of this stuff about capitalism being evil. And, the not so subterranean narrative to that is the Jews run capitalism. So it wasn't surprising that the far left was absolutely shameless in hitting Israel in the way that it was, in demonizing Israel, but in anti-Semitic terms and talking about Jews generally and getting away with it, because now all bets were off. Anti-Semitism was no longer the thing that could never be accepted in polite society, because it could be framed as we're not being anti-Jew, we're being anti-Israel. So I think that's been the great cover and the great reason why it has been allowed to take over. Because even people of goodwill who are genuinely horrified by the overt anti-Semitism, framing Jews as being beyond the pale, they can't deal with this because they can't unpick the Israel Zionist element, because they themselves share part of that thinking. So, even if Keir Starmer becomes leader of the Labour Party, I'm sure he's an absolutely decent man. I'm absolutely certain of it. He doesn't have anti-Semitic views. He's not of the far left. But he's going to find it, I would say, overwhelmingly difficult to rid his party of this. Because it's not just Corbyn. It's not just the extreme left. It's not even just Labour. The Lib Dems are riddled with it. The whole of the progressive side of politics is riddled with this. And it's a very profound thing, but it is, as you suggest, as a phenomenon, people are remarking on the fact that it's something that has been associated with the far right, with Nazis in jackboots, and now it's the left. But I'm afraid people who think that are also being ahistorical. The left has always been profoundly anti-Jew. Karl Marx, who was born a Jew, converted, I believe, to Protestantism. His ideal society, as he set out in his writings, his ideal society had to be free of Jews. He wrote against Jews in the most vicious way. So this idea that the left was always was anti-fascist and therefore couldn't be anti-Semitic is nonsense. And also, finally, my final point is that the left thinks of itself as the embodiment of virtue, and so it cannot be racist and it cannot be anti-Semitic. That is completely untrue, and is you can prove it's untrue through the history of the left. It wraps itself in this mantle that it is virtuous and therefore can't be ever guilty of any of these terrible things, and it is indeed guilty of such terrible things.
Possibly no journalist currently in the United States has had the same impact upon a whole generation of young millennials and older individuals as Matt Taibbi. Matt is the author of so many good books and writings, but right now he's taken on the challenge to go after the author of White Fragility. And he dismantles the so-called woke, corrupt race book. And I compare this new book, White Fragility, as an absolute, in my opinion, racist book, extraordinarily dangerous, because what her bottom line message is, at its core, is that if you're born white, you're born a racist, and there's nothing you can do except try to do everything humanly possible not to act white. It is one of the dumbest, most intellectually bankrupt concepts and extremely racist concepts. This is racism in reverse, and it's still racist. And yet now they're talking about teaching this in high schools and colleges as mandatory. And I gave a whole history of Mao Zedong's Little Red Book, and how a whole generation of Chinese young people grew up not knowing the real world, only knowing his truths and the consequences to their civilization, their art, their history. All of that was destroyed by Mao. And in its place was put his thoughts. And he was a narcissistic megalomaniac. Well, the consequences of blaming all Caucasians as being racist is obscene, and yet the intelligentsia, the people on the left and right that we would normally expect to come out and challenge it, have been muted. And more importantly, the young and unfortunately not very bright idealists who are leading this challenge are not looking at all the other factors that contribute to us working together, growing together, and being in harmony. That's a disappointment, as if the civil rights movement didn't occur, as if major gains never happened, as if we haven't learned solidarity, a purpose, a meaning in life. Now to Matt Taibbi.
Matt, as you said, you're on the verge of getting canceled again for daring to go after this White Fragility book. What is it about? I mean, you wrote just an incredible scathing takedown of it, but what is it about the work itself that you find most morally objectionable?
So it's funny, if you took parts of the book and just looked at the areas where she's trying to bring the attention of white people to structural inequities, to different kinds of situations that they might not be aware of, because being white, you're raised in a situation where you're simply not aware of certain factors. All those things are very positive. The problem is she has this other, she wraps it up in this all-encompassing theory that basically says that the people are defined by their race or by the perception of their race, that these categories are inflexible, and that the only thing you can hope to do but to combat the ongoing problem of racism is to relentlessly focus on race and commit to a lifelong program of striving to be less white. Which it's a very strange theology, which is, I guess, becoming sort of academic mainstream now. But the book itself has a lot of very odd theories connected to some pretty uncontroversial and positive theories.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I saw that book hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list in the wake of these protests, I remember thinking to myself, oh boy, people are going to actually take a look at this book. And then it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
And right. You know, there are some odd academic strains that are running through this. But Matt, talk a little bit about the corporate strains running through this, because this flows out of the kind of corporate diversity industrial complex,
yes.
so to speak. And, you know, she is a corporate consultant who is brought in to train corporate employees on how to interact in a corporate workplace on behalf of corporations. In other words, her job is to, you know, make the corporation a better place. Have you ever interacted with any of these consultants? Do you know much about this industry?
I don't know a whole lot about this industry. I have encountered this kind of person a couple of times, but not, I have to say, admit, not extensively. But you're right. There's a couple of things going on here. First, the extraordinary irony of white America in the wake of this racial tragedy in Minneapolis elevating, of all things, a white corporate consultant to number one on the Amazon bestseller list because this is how they want to reinterpret their racial issues. But you're right. This is the racism problem as seen through the lens of somebody who makes thousands of dollars an hour being hired by companies to address. Normally, it's to address an internal toxicity issue. So what they do is they bring in these people who come from, you know, various academic outposts, and they bring teams in and they have trainings where they facilitate anti-racism dialogues, and employees are sort of herded into these trainings and forced to listen to these speeches. And that's the lens through which her theories come. This is how corporate America views the race problem. It views it as an individual issue that where racism is sort of inexorably stuck in all of us, and the only way that we can combat it is through relentlessly listening to corporate consultants tell us how to fight it. And right. That's the irony here, is that I think the problem with this book ultimately is that this is the corporate vision of how to tackle racism. It's just to hire people like this to run through every company and search out racism in every corner, which could mean a thousand different things that aren't necessarily good.
Right, that's what I find so objectionable about it, too. Can you describe, my favorite part of your piece is about the Jackie Robinson section and about how D'Angelo rewrites history based on Jackie Robinson in order to cast it in this new theology and image. I just think it's a perfect encapsulation of how destructive this ideology is.
Yeah, it was very odd. I almost wondered whether the book had an editor, because she wrote this section about Jackie Robinson, and her point was the Jackie Robinson story was a myth that white America shared, that he was he was an exceptional ball player, and essentially the legend was that he was the first black man who was able to play with whites. Play baseball with white people on the merits, and mm-hmm. that his story had invisibilized white racism, racist structures, and privilege, which is the exact opposite of what that story means to basically everybody who's ever encountered that story. In fact, I think I would argue that the Jackie Robinson story is probably the first way that most non-academic Americans were introduced to the concept of privilege, because this was a story about a whole generation of mediocre white ball players who were, you know, sort of unfairly elevated to positions that they otherwise would have been displaced from by superior black ball players who were being kept in the Negro Leagues. So the story means exactly the opposite of what she thinks it does.
Right.
But it's very, very strange that, you know, I think one of the things that happens is when you're in an echo chamber academically and nobody around you is disagreeing with you all the time, you can see your theory everywhere and just never have anybody disagree with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wanted to pick on something you mentioned earlier, that, you know, these corporate consultants are brought in after some toxic event takes place inside a corporation that leads to complaints. And so at this point, the corporation is, you know, essentially trying to stamp out whatever protest it is they're getting from within that corporation, rather than trying to kind of meet the demands of whatever that protester had said. And so they think, if we let them talk long enough, maybe this will fizzle out and talk in different ways. What do you think the actual end goal of establishing these ideas is for these companies and for, you know, the authors of these mm-hmm. kinds of books?
Well, I think broadly speaking, corporations would much rather bring in people like this to essentially, you're right. Usually the story is they're getting a complaint either from the outside or from the inside about a toxic situation within the workplace. So what do they do to remedy it? They agree to bring in an outside consultant and do a review and then conduct training. and they pay enormous sums of money to these academics who come in. And so the corporation wants a gold star that it can show to the public to say that it's fixed its problem. But it also sets up a new culture wherein essentially there's sort of a permanent ongoing review of the entire company. And that can also have utility because it's a very useful way of getting rid of troublesome employees. Internal complaints that anonymously can be sent to all sorts of people. But I think more broadly speaking, the problem is that corporate America would much rather deal with the racism problem in this manner than do things like, I don't know, give Medicare for all or do other right. structural reforms that would be much more difficult, much more painful. Here they can handle racism as an HR issue and just by hiring a high-priced consultant.
I think you are hitting exactly the nail on the head, which is that Amazon will take the deal every day of the week to be able to hire Robin DiAngelo and put Black Lives Matter banner up at the top, as long as they don't have to actually pay their black working class workers exactly. more, or if face tough questions about how they treat their workforce. So thank you for spotlighting an issue like this, Matt. We really appreciate you joining the show.
Our final guest today to hear from is a person that most Americans have not heard about. His name is Douglas Murray. He is a conservative, and he is going to offer his perspective on wokeness, the new Western morality. And either agree or disagree as you will, in part or whole, but we should hear voices like this, and we should have the best people as far as the logic they bring forth and see, would we agree or disagree? Is there something we could gain by staying neutral till we hear someone through to see, does this challenge us in our own beliefs, or does it enlighten us? Now to Douglas Murray.
One of the things I started to notice in the last 15 or so years in particular was that effectively a new metaphysics, that is a new foundational morality, appeared to be getting installed in our society. And it went something like this. And again, one can regret this or admire it, but I think most people will recognize something like it. That not very long ago, if you wanted to be seen to be an ethical or good person, there were certain things that were perhaps expected of you. Broadly speaking, they were the inheritance of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And this included things like charity, forgiveness, virtue, as understood in that tradition, and a lot more. And then at some point in the last 15 years, I say sped up very clearly in the last 10 years and then weaponized in the last five, we see this another form of morality, not totally dissimilar in some of its appearances. And that is that in order to be a good person, to be seen as a good person in a society like Australia or Britain, you would need to stress, for instance, that you were anti-racist, as if everybody else in society was profoundly racist and you were one of the few brave souls willing still to battle racism. You would need to present yourself as being entirely on the side of women in any and all circumstances and really talk about it an awful lot. You know, if you're a man, stress your feminist credentials, a tendency which, as you know from reading The Madness of Crowds, I'm intensely skeptical of. You need to talk about LGBT all the time, or at least as often as possible. And these, as well as a few other things, you might add in green and perhaps a couple of other things, became what you stress in order to show that you're a good person. Now, these in the end, I started to realize, were becoming load-bearing walls, which I became very worried about, and am very worried about, because they can't bear the load. My view is that LGBT rights, equal white rights for women, equal rights for people, whatever their racial origin, is a very desirable endpoint. But it's an endpoint of liberalism in the good sense, as we might understand it. It's a hideous foundation. Why? For two reasons in particular. The first is that all of these bases for a new morality have intense friction among themselves. So, as I point out in the trans chapter, trans and women have intense friction as rights claims for reasons I explain. Trans and gay have intense friction between them, for reasons I go into in The Madness of Crowds. But there's a second reason as well, which is that all of these things that we have been in societies like Australia trying to base our morality on are themselves much more unstable components than we've been willing to admit. So I say in the gay chapter at the outset, and I do gay at the outset partly because it's the only one of these minority things I can claim to have any crampons on the wall of the important Everest of liberal rights. Gay is much more unstable than we're willing to admit in our societies. We still don't know very much about it. I think we have to be a bit more humble about some of the issues around it as a result of that. But I get on then to the women chapter, and I say, this one also is much more unstable than we're willing to admit. Are women and men exactly equal? Are men more competent than women in certain areas? Are women more competent than men in certain areas? Or have we, just for convenience for the time being, landed, for instance, in this strange place I think we're in, where we have to pretend that women are exactly the same as men and also magically better? We're very uncertain about this. We tend to be totally certain, but we're very uncertain. Race, absolute mess, which we've been trying to think about and deal with as well as we can, but there's a whole load of hell waiting for us if we keep leaning on it this hard. And then trans, which we know almost nothing about, and our societies are pretending to be incredibly certain about. And if I can sum up the problem in this in a sentence, it is that this new morality we're trying to construct relies on us pretending we know about things that we don't know about, trans, and simultaneously demands that we pretend not to know about things that we all knew till yesterday, relations between the sexes.
It's very interesting to me that you clearly spell out the thing that you've just said in the book on gays, that there are enormous differences within each grouping under their heading, so gays, lesbians, and so forth, and enormous differences, even frictions, between them.
Yes.
And in many ways, it's, I would imagine, quite deeply resented. I mean, during the gay marriage debate in Australia, anybody who was watching the debate closely could see there was quite a range of views in the gay community.
Right.
Quite a range.
Sure.
And in fact, there were quite a few who said, we've never believed in marriage. Mm-hmm. Why would we want to sure. do it?
Yeah, there were some who said, yeah.
But of course, you didn't see that in the media. It didn't suit the narrative. You've got other people, it seems, often using, in inverted commas, these groupings that they've put together and insist are cogent and
right.
hang together to pursue agendas of their own.
Well, often to pursue a specific political objective.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote a piece in The Spectator in the UK in support of gay marriage before it was popular to be in support of gay marriage, and explained what I regard as being the conservative case for it, which was an article which David Cameron used as a basis for his first main speech on the issue. I defend it as a right, but I also am worried by, and have been worried for a long time, by the extraordinary intolerance of elements of the so-called gay community, which I say so-called because there is no such thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
so this is one of the interesting aspects of this. There are a lot of gay people who don't want to be defined by sure. their sexuality.
Well, just
they
like,
are
yeah.
a whole heap of other things.
Yeah.
They're citizens. They might be boilermakers. They might be city executives or what have you. But suddenly there's an insistence that they define themselves.
Yeah, and this has come in very recently. And it's come in each of the ones I describe. And it's a basis for madness. When people say the gay community, who are you talking about? It's like women think this. Oh, really? 50% of the species all agree on something. Blacks say this. Really? Let me put it another way. If somebody said, I just love the working class.
I want to thank you all for listening today to the Progressive Commentary Hour. You've had a chance to hear three remarkable people, like or dislike them, but nowhere in American media, on almost any of the forums, we hear their voices. And that's the unfortunate part. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know.